Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Hoo-wah! The Frontlines of Freedom team really appreciate you joining us this fine day in America. We are proud Americans. Hey, troops, if you like coffee, and who doesn't, you may want to try Freedom One Coffee. It's run by an active duty couple who love our nation and coffee. Everything, even the packaging, is cool. Check freedom1coffee.com. Here's what we have for you this hour. We're going to start by talking with Mark Hager about a World War II vet, Harold Frank, who was at D-Day in 1944. Then we'll meet Mike LaMonica and discuss the Combat Control Foundation. And of course, we'll conclude with military history and our self-defense report. So it's a pleasure to introduce Mark Hager. He's the president of the Forks of the Yadkin Museum in Mocksville, North Carolina. I suspect, like most listeners know, that the 77th anniversary of D-Day in Normandy was last Monday. Well, Mark is the author of the last of the 357th Infantry, Harold Frank's World War II story of faith and courage. Harold's the last living veteran of the 357th Infantry and Bronze Star recipient on the beaches of Normandy during the largest seaborne invasion in all of history. Wow. Welcome, Mark. Glad you could join us.
Oh, it's good to be here. And yes, when you look at Company G, 2nd Battalion, 357th Infantry, I just can't find any other that's left that came in at least at D-Day plus D-Day or D-Day plus four. So Harold is, there are getting to be very few of them left. That's for sure.
That's very true. Mark, let's start with a bit of your background. You're an Army vet. When, why did you join? What'd you do?
Well, our family, we have a long line of military service all the way back through the Revolution, which we talked about a little bit before we came on the air. And so, but when I was in high school, that's all I wanted to do first and foremost. And in fact, wouldn't play any major sports my 11th and 12th grade year in high school because I didn't want to get hurt so I could pursue my stint within the U.S. Army. And for whatever reason, I had a fascination with artillery. And so I went to basic training at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, in late 83 into 84 to become a field artillery surveyor specialist, as the way the recruiters like to put that. And so completed that training successfully and then went overseas for 2 years to Germany right before the end of the Cold War. And so I got to learn an awful lot about World War II battlefields, besides, you know, knowledge from family members who were in World War II, an uncle that was at Anzio and a first cousin who was on the Pennsylvania at Pearl Harbor. So I'd already was kind of raised a little bit of knowledge about it, but it was neat to go to the actual sites, which is what fell in tongue and groove right into the Harold Frank story when I was shocked when at an accidental meeting to meet him. And so, but from there, I was in the 24th Infantry down at Fort Stewart, Georgia, and now stationed in Texas at Fort Sam Houston for a while before getting out and then going back to school and excelled well through college and then graduate school and went into public history, and which was a dash of archaeology and a little bit of preservation work on, especially from the American Battlefield Protection Program, which I worked within to try to preserve battlefields of the Revolution, and was at Guilford Courthouse, National Military Park for a while. And then continued on from that into teaching collegiately at Lenoir Ryan University. And boy, wow, I got into documentaries and started pursuing that for a while too, and then was asked to get on the board with the Forks of the Yadkin Davie County History Museum in Mocksville, which is claimed to fame as the Boone era, in which Daniel Boone's parents are buried in Davie County, North Carolina, and we don't have a museum. So I was brought on board to work on that project, which we're still working on now. And wow. So
it sounds like you just got on this path and that's where it led. And suddenly you're the president of a museum and it sounds like you're not bored.
No, try to stay busy all I can. And history is what I live, eat and breathe, and trying to preserve it and find different ways of explaining it, so people of different ages and groups can get a better grasp of what it was like to live back then at whatever point.
Amen. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're about to discuss D-Day with author Mark Hager. Mark, I consider the invasion of Europe on D-Day probably the most amazing military action and one of the most critical in our nation's history. Talk to us about it. Give us a little background on that, will you?
Well, D-Day, I have learned so much with doing Harold's story. D-Day actually began in 1942, 2 years before. And it's kind of a weird term. I call the first D-Day was the attack on Dieppe, France, in which Canadian and some American and French forces combined together and raided and attacked five beaches up in northern France with the hope of trying to gain a foothold. What it was an experiment to see what would happen if you had a the D-Day invasion. Same thing, had five beaches. Each one has certain objectives, just like we think of Normandy 2 years later. But it was a huge failure for any military historian knows, and ended up with 6,000 troops, 4,000 casualties. Just a visit to the cemetery at Dieppe is an eye-awakening moment, because you realize these guys were being sacrificed in Canada. They thought needlessly to try to gain intelligence of what would happen. And that's where they realized they've got to take samples of sand and examine to where, because they realized you could not take a port. It would be suicide to try to take a deep water port, which was at Cherbourg in Normandy. And that just brought about the realization that to do a real invasion is going to take time. It's going to take all kinds of logistical nightmares to overcome, which had never happened before. I mean, something of this scale, they're going to have to bring a dock, two different docks, to the beaches, because they knew they couldn't take Cherbourg. So then they had to find a beach that a tank could actually sit on at Dieppe. When the tanks, the few that made it in, and they just bogged down on what they call the shingle and couldn't even move. Just the faster they went, the more they dug into the rock shingles that were on the beach and became targets, targets for
it. You know, that's incredible. You have to think about all those things.
Yes.
It's not just, oh, here's a beach we can go ashore, or here's a port we want. Little things like, can the tanks make it over the beach is a rather important question, isn't it?
Oh, it is. And on top of that, you've got to have complete air superiority, which they didn't have at Dieppe, and it has to be continual. You've got to have artillery support, because you're going to need it. The Atlantic curtain that Hitler had constructed under Rommel was nothing short of magnificent. And to overcome it, it would take a lot of daring, a lot of skill, and the divisions that were going to have to be organized. One of the other things that I learned about the D-Day invasion, the one in Normandy beginning on June the 6th, was that there would be multiple layers of division after division after division. And so when Eisenhower gave that moment to where he said, go, forget the storms, let's just go. When he said go, you set a chain reaction that could not stop. Whoever hit those beaches, there are waves coming behind it. That's why D-Day is remembered as D-Day, D-Day plus one, D-Day plus two, D-Day plus three, D-Day plus 16, D-Day plus two. It's going to take 7 weeks for the D-Day operation to actually move 17 miles in. And each one is dependent upon wave after wave of troops, in which Harold's going to be brought in with the 90th Division. Say that's roughly D-Day plus four to D-Day plus six as they mass their troops on Utah Beach.
Okay.
And they try to break through the hedgerows.
There's more to discuss about Harold Frank. Indeed, we're just getting to him. And D-Day and Mark will stay with us. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, it's time to run hard for a couple of miles. Do this while thinking patriotic thoughts. Mark and I will be right back.
The VA frequently denies veterans disability benefits for PTSD. Barry Law has been helping fellow veterans with PTSD fight for compensation for over 20 years. At Barry Law, We've spent decades building a team of attorneys, veterans, and former VA employees to provide veterans with maximum firepower when appealing VA decisions. To appeal your decision, visit PTSDlawyers.com.
Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to vetted veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Thanks for joining us today on Frontlines of Freedom. We're continuing our conversation with Mark Hagar about World War II vet Harold Frank, who was on the beach on D-Day, one of the D-Days, in 1944. Okay, talk to us about Harold Frank.
Well, Harold, we had a chance encounter. I was helping a local farmer who had bought a large tract of land in Davie County. And on it, fortunate for him, he had a very historic home in which he contacted me, being the museum guy for that region, about some ideas to do with it. And so I went over and sure enough, you know, talked a lot about different ideas and things to do. And out of gratitude, he invited me to a farmer's luncheon, in which I went to. And as my wife would say, I got there late as usual. And when I'm not in the military, I'm going, hey, I don't have to be there exactly on time. But I got there and looking around for a place to sit when I grabbed my food through the chow line. If I don't recognize some people, I'll try to spot a veteran and go and sit near one of them. And saw one older gentleman with a POW cap and walked over and sat down. And I thought maybe he's in his 70s, maybe 80 years old. So I'm thinking this early Vietnam, maybe, or not sure. And asked if I could sit next to him. He said, sure. And so sat down. We started a conversation, asked what unit he was with. And he said the 357th Infantry. And I just kind of looked dumbfounded at him for a minute and then was going, okay, I know this county really well. I don't know him, but I do know from my time in Europe in the Army that the 357th was with the 90th Infantry, the Tough Hombres, Texas, Oklahoma Division. And so I asked him, I said, you mean you were with the 90th Infantry Division? He said, yes, you know of us. And I said, I know the 357th, 358th, and 359th were virtually wiped out two or three different times during the Normandy campaign. And he, you know, kind of got emotional and talked about the men that they lost. And I was going, I don't get it. Why do I not? How is he here? And they lost 115% of their men within 2 weeks. So that started the conversation. And by the time we hadn't even concluded talking, I ran out of napkins to write on. And farmer, mutual friend of ours, everyone else had left. And he said, you know, I can take you to his farm, and which he agreed to. And what had happened was his wife of 68 years that year had passed away back in 2016. And she had prodded him over and over to one day tell a story because he wouldn't even tell her, just little bits and pieces. And she was always wanting to know a little bit more about what had happened. I mean, she practically did save his life after he comes back recovering from a POW and his battlefield wounds. But he decided then and there after meeting me that now's the time. And so that's the chance encounter that started the movement towards a book. And the complication, I stress to people who want to do this, be careful, because you take a person who spent 75 years trying to remove all the memories of war and being a POW. You start bringing them back to life, you know, they will tell you they will have nightmares. And so trying to put the bits and pieces together for him became a chore. So it took about 2 years of careful questioning and using video cameras and such to put his story together. And so, and that's what I've done with this book, and found one thing lacking in history is that Greatest Generation. Well, let's back up. And you got to start. I found an event that happened when he was 5 years old. That's where I'm going to start with this book. You're going to be with Harold. You're going to be in his shoes through the whole book, starting when he is 5 years old, getting up each morning from underneath his quilts made out of burlap sacks in a house that had no indoor plumbing or heating on a farm to where there's no hardware stores. That it was a time to where you make what you need and then you learn to make it so it doesn't break. Very resourceful. And, you know, when he gets drafted, one of the problems that you immediately understand with his story is that not only is he got to go defend the nation, but the farm's going to be in jeopardy. He's the oldest son who was had so much depended upon him. He was a man by the time he was 12 years old. And so he knew that him leaving is going to be a burden to the success of the farm. And all he wanted to do was to get back as soon as possible.
You know, that's an amazing insight that, again, we don't get. I'm so glad you're here sharing that aspect of his life. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with author Mark Hager about D-Day. Keep going. Tell us more about Harold.
Well, so when he goes to basic training, he is going to be with the 69th Infantry Division that was reactivated and brought to Camp Shelby, Mississippi, in the 271st Infantry Regiment. But his dad and his uncle taught him before he was six that the importance of firearms and firearm safety. And it was like this, is that before we take you hunting with it, you got to first show how you take it apart, put it back together, how it's properly cleaned, exactly what this round is capable of, whether it was an Ivy Johnson 12-gauge shotgun or a 22 or whatever it was. And so he learned, because you can't waste ammo because they don't have money. I mean, even the BB gun he started off with, they've got to hit targets where he could pry the BBs back out so they could shoot again. So when he goes to basic, he's amazed when a sergeant stands up at one point and says, "I'm holding a BAR," which in the military, even for my generation, we called it the badass rifle, 20 pounds, 30 odd six. We didn't carry it, but we knew of it. That sergeant looked out and said it shoots several hundred rounds per minute. Would anyone, before he even finished saying volunteer, his hand was already up. He says, "I'll take it, Sergeant." He fell in love with that weapon and learned it inside and out, just like his training growing up, to where he could not only take it apart and put it back together in 10 minutes blindfolded, but was one of the best shots in the 271st. And they tried to get him to stay and offered him, you know, promotion to stay at Camp Shelby to help train others with it. But again, he wanted to get this war over with, and he was there to go after Germans and Japanese, as he would say. And so one day during a road march, he and a number of other soldiers were called out of their ranks, and he noticed they were all BAR guys and pretty good ones. And they were pulled, and they didn't know it then, but they were given a furlough. And then when they reported back, sent to Camp Shanks, New York. And then next thing they knew, they were on troop ship heading over to England, and they're in training operations for what would become the Normandy invasion. And at first he's doing the same thing. He's helping people with the BAR. He wasn't with the 69th. He's been pulled from it. So technically he is a replacement. And as he was noted within his training, he moves over and he is near the training area of the 90th Infantry Division. And so that's how he gets attached. And the 90th arrives on Normandy. The 357th, some of the early elements arrive on D-Day, but their task is to prepare the beach area because the entire division's coming in, and their task is, as the 4th turns from Utah and head towards the only major port, which was Cherbourg, they needed someone to block any attempts by the Germans to reinforce Cherbourg and to stop any Germans that are trying to get out of Cherbourg. And so that was the task of the 90th Division, fighting on two fronts.
I wish we could keep going, but we're running out of time. So the way people are going to get the rest of the story is to buy the book. How can they get a copy of your book?
You can find it anywhere. If you just Google "The Last of the 357th Infantry," it is at Barnes & Noble's, at Amazon, Books A Million, just about anywhere. And it is the feature book, and it's going quite well. And got to remember one other point about Harold's story. So he gets shot with an armor-piercing round that doesn't kill him, lodges in his shoulder. And at one point, he's in a Nazi POW camp for 10 months in Dresden. So then he survives a 1,000-plane bombing of Dresden.
He had quite a history.
And yes, he did.
That book is amazing. Mark, thank you. Thank you for taking time to join us today. Thank you for your efforts to preserve history in our great nation. Thank you for your service to our nation.
Well, thank you.
Coming up next on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll talk with Mike LaMonica about the Combat Control Foundation. Then we'll open our weekly mailbag. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for one-arm push-ups. Just do a dozen with each arm, twice, then take a break to stay in the area. I'll be right back.
HelpVet.net was created to be the nation's number one resource center for all veterans, active military, and families. At HelpVet.net, you'll find up-to-date information on benefits available through the VA, resources on education, employment, health and wellness, and more. Find hundreds of nationally recognized organizations offering discounts on products and services, as well as local organizations from attorneys to yoga studios. You'll find them at HelpVet.net. Visit HelpVet.net for all your family's needs.
If you are suffering from anxiety, joint muscle aches, or trouble sleeping, try Day 3 Creation, a Christian family-owned provider of American-made, non-intoxicating, non-addictive CBD products created from natural, organic, laboratory-tested ingredients. Day 3 comes from a servant's heart as God calls us to care for each other with compassion and honesty. 10% of all profits go to Patriot Paws, providing disabled vets with service dogs. Visit day3creation.com. to learn more. God bless.
Nearly 30% of veterans have disabilities caused by military service. At Berry Law, we fight to make sure that every veteran receives full compensation for their injuries. Our team of attorneys, veterans, and former VA employees have helped veterans recover over $100 million in back pay from inadequate VA decisions. For a free consultation, call 888-883-2483.
Welcome back to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Groups, I really do welcome your comments and questions. Contact me through frontlinesoffreedom.com, or you can comment on Facebook. It's a pleasure to welcome Air Force vet Mike LaMonica. Mike runs the Combat Control Foundation. They're a nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting the Air Force Special Operations Command and Control teams and their families during times of need. So welcome to the show, Mike. Glad you could join us.
Hey, Dennis. Thanks for having me. I'm grateful to be here today.
Start by telling us a bit about your military service. When and why did you join, and what did you do?
I joined in 1987, and the reason I joined was, there was a number of reasons, but the biggest reason was, as I was growing up, the people who I looked up to most all had a common thing, and that common thing was they all had military background. And what I observed as a young guy is the closer to the front lines they were, the more I enjoyed being around them. I can't tell you why that was, but it was just the way it was. So I joined in 1987. While I was in basic training, I learned about combat control. And I went, man, I want to go try out for that thing. It really sounded neat. You get to jump out of airplanes, scuba dive, ride motorcycles, fast jump out of airplanes, or helicopters, things like that. And that's just the way to get to work. And once you get on the ground, you do all these really neat things that are unique to the Air Force. So I tried out. I went through a 18-month pipeline. About 100 of us started, 15 of us graduated. And from there on, I just spent my entire career as a combat controller. And it was just a great opportunity for me. I felt like I was at home my entire career. I was fortunate enough to serve both during peacetime and wartime. And I've been on humanitarian missions and combat missions. And all of those helped to shape me into the guy I am today. And more importantly, I got to be surrounded by great people. When you enter into the special operations community, you are surrounded by people who are high achievers, who really want to be there on the front lines. And everything they do is for the guy next to him or the gal next to him. And that's one of the things I enjoyed most about being in that community.
Well, that makes real sense. The team feeling is true for everybody in the military, but the more, shall we say, intense your organization is, the more that feeling is true. So I relate to that totally. And unlike you, I was the only person in my family direct line ever to wear the uniform, though they were cops. So there's a parallel. But something just attracted me, and I can't tell you what it was, but I stayed for a full career. So I think we got a lot in common. Okay, the Combat Control Foundation. What is it? Why do you need it? How did it get started?
You know, combat control as a career field in the Air Force and Special Operations has been around since 1953. We've had an association, so a fraternal military organization that allows us to gather and take care of each other. We've had that since the mid-70s. And with that association, we would host reunions, but we'd also raise money to help each other. But we weren't really efficient in how we did it. A lot of it resulted in passing the hat, right? Hey, Joey's forward. Joey got shot. We're bringing Joey home. We're meeting him at Walter Reed, and we'll pass the hat around inside of our home community to raise money. And we were raising inconsistent dollars, and we were taking care of each person very inconsistently and not very well, if you will. It's not that we weren't trying to. We didn't have good habits on how to best take care of people. So a handful of years ago, we started the Paperwork Work Foundation. We spent about 3 years creating the building blocks of the organization, if you will. And just last year, we then started reaching out and meeting donors who might want to help us. And it all got magnified by a book that was written by Dan Schilling, who is a teammate of mine, and the sister of John Chapman, Lori Chapman. They both wrote a book that paralleled John's life all the way up to where he earned the Medal of Honor in 2002 and the history of combat control. So it was a really neat book. And one of our donors, at the time, a potential donor, read the book and said, "Yeah, I'd love to meet you guys." So we went down and visited him. In visiting him, we then created an environment where we brought a bunch of donors in to see what we do. From there, we then got some donors who wanted to host fundraising events for us. And really, in August last year, we started raising funds. So that's fundamentally how we got to where we are. That's the history of it. I'll stop there, see if that draws any questions from you.
Well, I think, unlike what some special operators have the reputation undeserved, is you were doing positive prior planning. You actually took the time to set it up and do it right. Most civilians think special operators are sort of cowboys who shoot from the hip and don't think things through. But I think that's the opposite. I think most of the special operators I know in all services are much better at thinking things through than anything else, and then they can go do it. And so it sounds like that's the approach you took to putting this together. Did I read you right?
No, that's correct. It was almost painful because there were times, in those 3 years that we were setting the foundation, we had some pretty significant things happen where taking care of our folks was painful. And it really just shot a little bit of urgency into us on hey, we need to accelerate this and do better, because even though we're taking care of these folks and their families, we're not doing it the way we should. So it did push us to plan better and accelerate our timeline. But ultimately, it all worked out. And last year, we had a good fundraising year. And now we're able to take care of our people, and we're using a pillars approach, right? So we have resiliency, we have transition, we have some mental health things that we're working on, and education. Those are kind of the major themes of things we're working on. And inside of those, we have programs where we can now specifically address the needs of our community. And that's important, because if we're not addressing what they need, we can go raise all the money in the world, and it doesn't make a world of difference at all.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Mike LaMonica about the Combat Control Foundation. Mike, you're 100% right. You can raise all kinds of money, but if you aren't meeting needs, you're wasting money and not doing what you said you were doing. So that's really critical that you get focused. How do people who are eligible contact you? If somebody is in that category or knows somebody in that category who might be eligible, what's the process?
So, to somebody completely unknowing, I would say go on to our website, combatcontrol.team. It's that simple, combatcontrol.team. And there's a contact us button on there. If you're a donor and you just want to donate, there's a donate button on there. For combat controllers who are partially in the know, come to the association, let us get you signed up for the association and keep you in the fold. That is the benefit of the association versus the foundation. The foundation is a fundraising organization. The association is about keeping our teammates in the fold, because as you know, Dennis, when you got out 6 months later, you probably look around and go, man, I don't have my teammates or my soldiers around me. I don't have the infrastructure I'm used to having around me. When I have questions, I don't have people to lean on like I did in the military and all this structure around me. The association helps take care of that. Like, we're there, and I get a call probably once every 2 weeks from somebody who says, hey, Mike, I know somebody's having troubles. Here's what I know about it. Here's how I recommend you go about contacting them. And then we engage. And that allows us to engage people in a non-offensive way, right? We're not coming in and going, hey, what's your problem? We're coming in and go, hey, I understand there's some things going on. The association is tied in tightly with the foundation. We think we might be able to help if you're willing to let us come in and be part of this with you, walk the journey with you. And that typically allows us to have a meaningful conversation.
Well, that makes real sense, because you are, in fact, brothers acting like brothers with sensitivity. And I would suspect that's incredibly effective.
It is. It also works well with our spouses and our extended family members. We had a recently Gold Star mother who ran into some challenges. And when I called her, her immediate response was, well, I don't want to take away from anybody else. And I said, well, let's let's break down that myth now. Like, fundamentally what you're saying is, I don't want to go get my VA rating. If I get my VA rating, I'm taking away from somebody else who has a higher rating than me, right? And that's not how we look at it. What we look at is, what are the challenges you're going through? What do we think we can help you with? And let's come to a decision. And we'll go raise more money. Like that, we can make the pie bigger. We really need to take care of our folks. And one of the things I had to say to her was, look, if your son hadn't have died in combat 10 years ago, he'd be helping you work through this issue. So we are now your sons, let us help you work through this issue. And then she made me promise that we would let her help us raise funds, which we absolutely will. We'd love to have her at our fundraisers and let her talk. And in doing so, that then eased the conversation. And not only were we able to help her, but she feels like she is part of the larger solution for our entire community now. So people just want to give back. They always do. Unfortunately, most of us don't want to be takers, and our ego gets in the way. But if we can approach them the right way and help them find a meaningful solution that takes the stress out of their lives, well, then that's what we're here to do.
Mike, I couldn't have said anything better than you just did. If that isn't the best way to approach, the most sensitive, the most effective way to approach people, I don't know what is. Obviously, people who are not members of the combat control community, the one thing we can do is contribute, right?
Absolutely. Any contribution helps, right? $5, $500, $5,000, whatever it is, it all goes to the front lines. We have one paid employee, and his job is to manage all the chaos that is running a foundation. And he's very generous. He's not a highly paid employee, but he is a paid employee. And every other dollar we raise is really about taking care of our folks on the front lines. And, you know, another thing about our community, while it is the Combat Control Foundation and the Combat Control Association, we have associate members. There are people who spent their career working on our radios or taking care of our weapons or packing our parachutes for us, all those things. And we actually invite those people into the fold. Just last year, one of our riggers, he passed from COVID. And his wife was struggling because the insurance company wasn't paying quickly. And we came in and we paid 2 months of her bills to let her bridge until the insurance company did what they were supposed to do. And that brought her a great amount of relief, right? And again, our job is to take care of our people. And while it is the Combat Control Association Foundation, we also take care of our teammates who spent their entire career taking care of us.
Bro, that sounds awesome. Mike, thank you. Thank you for taking time to join us today. Thank you for your service to our nation in uniform, but thank you for what you're doing now. That's awesome. I'm proud to call you a friend.
Dennis, thank you very much. Thanks for having us on Frontlines of Freedom. We're grateful for your time and grateful for your friendship.
Troops, if you're a veteran right who's now having trouble getting your disability approved by the VA, contact Barry Law. Reach them at PTSDlawyers.com. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Next up, it's time for our weekly mailbag. Then it's military history time. You reported for duty to Frontlines of Freedom. Stand tall, troops. Let's do some more push-ups now. 60 this time. And once your ranger ready, then stand at ease.
Fresh, flash, frozen from the American farmer every time. PatriotFoods.com. Hit the shop now button. You're supporting a veteran family in need every time you shop. Look at us online, see how we give back. For the servicemen and women of this great country, we are fighting for the American farmer. PatriotFoods.com, promo code FREEDOM, 10% off today, folks. Shop now.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum. I buy Patriot Foods. It's great. PatriotFoods.com, promo code FREEDOM.
$30 trillion in debt, 20 years of endless war, and veterans not able to get the care they deserve. These are some of the issues concerned Veterans for America is confronting head on. At CVA, we aim to amplify the veteran perspective to create a better future for all Americans. But we need your help. Join CVA in shaping a better tomorrow for you, your family, and your community. Visit cv4a.org to learn more and join the movement. That's cv4a.org.
I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. This is the final formation for this week on Frontlines of Freedom. Okay, team, it's mailbag time. I welcome comments from you, our listeners. Do send your thoughts to me at Danny@frontlinesoffreedom.com or on Facebook. Hey, what's the first comment, Skip?
Well, an Air Force vet, Peter, really enjoyed the 15th anniversary show. He liked the change in format and the different interviews, especially the one of the Colonel.
Peter, it was a fun show. I found that I much prefer doing interviews than being interviewed. But thanks for your comment.
And Sue is an Army junior ROTC student who really likes the show. She was surprised to find out that the show is as old as she is.
Well, then we share a birthday, Sue. Have a great year. And now it's time for military history. What's the first one, Skip?
Well, on 14 June 1775, during our revolt against England, Congress adopted the American Continental Army after reaching a consensus position in the Committee of the Whole. This procedure and the desire for secrecy account for the sparseness of the official journal entries for the day. The record indicates only that Congress undertook to raise 10 companies of riflemen, approved an enlistment form for them, and appointed a committee, including Washington and Schuyler, to draft rules and regulations for the government of the Army. June 14th is our Army's birthday.
Happy birthday, Mother Army. And on 17 June 1775, during the Revolutionary War, British General William Howe landed his troops at the Charlestown Peninsula overlooking Boston and led them against Breed's Hill, a fortified position just below Bunker Hill. As the British advanced, American General William Prescott reportedly told his men, "Don't one of you fire till you see the whites of their eyes." When the Redcoats were within 40 yards, the Americans let loose with a lethal barrage of musket fire, throwing the British into retreat. Howe attacked again with much the same results. Prescott's men were now low on ammunition, though, and when Howe attacked for a third time, they reached the redoubts and engaged the Americans in hand-to-hand combat. The outnumbered Americans were forced to retreat. However, by the end of the engagement, the Patriots' gunfire had cut down nearly 1,000 enemy troops, including 92 officers. Of the 370 Patriots who fell, most were struck while in retreat. The British had won the so-called Battle of Bunker Hill, and Breed's Hill and the Charlestown Peninsula fell firmly under British control. Despite losing the strategic position, the battle was a morale builder for the Americans, convincing them that patriotic dedication could overcome superior British military might. The British entered the Battle of Bunker Hill overconfident. Had they merely guarded Charlestown Neck, they could have isolated the Patriots with little loss of life. Instead, Howe had chosen to try to wipe out the Yankees by marching 2,400 men into a frontal assault on the Patriots' well-defended position on the top of the hill. The British would never make that same mistake again.
And on 14 June 1777, during the Revolutionary War, the Continental Congress adopted a resolution stating that the flag of the United States be 13 alternate stripes, red and white, and that the Union be 13 stars, white in a blue field, representing a new constellation. The national flag, which became known as the Stars and Stripes, was based on the Grand Union flag, a banner carried by the Continental Army in 1776 that also consisted of 13 red and white stripes. According to legend, Philadelphia seamstress Betsy Ross designed the new Stars and Stripes, which consisted of a circle of 13 stars and a blue background, at the request of General George Washington. Historians have been unable to conclusively prove or disprove this legend. With the entrance of new states into the U.S. after independence, new stripes and stars were added to represent new additions to the Union. In 1818, however, Congress enacted a law stipulating that the 13 original stripes be restored and that only stars be added to represent new states. June 14 is celebrated as Flag Day as well as the Army's birthday.
A twofer. And on 15 June 1877, Henry Ossian Flipper, born a slave in Thomasville, Georgia in 1856, became the first African-American cadet to graduate from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. Flipper, who was never spoken to by a white cadet during his 4 years, was appointed a second lieutenant in the all-African-American 10th Cavalry stationed at Fort Sill in Indian Territory. 10 years after the establishment of the U.S. Military Academy in 1802, the growing threat of another war with Great Britain resulted in the congressional action to expand the Academy's facilities and increase the West Point Corps. Beginning in 1817, the U.S. Military Academy was reorganized by the Superintendent Sylvanus Thayer, later on known as the father of West Point, and the school became one of the nation's finest sources of civil engineers. During the Mexican-American War, West Point graduates filled the leading ranks of the victorious U.S. forces, and with the outbreak of the Civil War, former West Point classmates regretfully lined up against one another in the defense of their native states. In 1870, the first African-American cadet, James Webster Smith, was admitted to the academy but didn't complete the program. In 1877, Henry Flipper became the first to graduate. In 1976, the first female cadets were admitted. The academy now has an enrollment of over 4,000 students.
On June 16, 1961, following a meeting between President John Kennedy and South Vietnam envoy Nguyen Dinh Thuan, an agreement was reached for direct training and combat supervision of Vietnamese troops by U.S. instructors. South Vietnamese President Diem had earlier asked Kennedy to send additional U.S. troops to train the South Vietnamese Army. U.S. advisors had been serving in Vietnam since 1955 as part of our Military Assistance Advisory Group. There would be only 900 U.S. military personnel in South Vietnam at the end of 1961. But in accordance with President Kennedy's pledge, the number of U.S. personnel rose to 3,200 by the end of 1962. There were 16,000 of our troops there by the time of Kennedy's assassination in November 1963.
And that's military history for today. Now it's time for our self-defense report. Take us there, Skip.
All of us here at Frontlines of Freedom want our listeners to get trained and get armed in that order. We fully support the right to keep and bear arms for all law-abiding families, and we encourage you to find out about the laws governing use of deadly force in your state and follow them to the letter. And of course, don't forget to follow the rules of safety and common sense whenever you're carrying a firearm to protect the ones you love. What's the story this week, Colonel?
Police in Charleston, West Virginia are praising a woman who fatally shot a gunman who fired a rifle at dozens of graduation party attendees last week. The investigator said Dennis Butler was warned Wednesday about speeding near the Vista View Apartments complex with children present before he departed and then returned with an AR-15-style rifle and began firing into the crowd. Police said a bystander attending the party quickly pulled out her handgun and shot Butler. Officers arriving at 10:45 p.m. found Butler with multiple gunshot wounds, adding that he later died. There were no reports of injuries to any of those attending the party. No charges have been filed against the citizen defender.
Thanks, Colonel. Almost every day, we listen to reports of bad guys shooting innocent people. But the media many times gives the impression that a perfectly normal and emotionally healthy citizen suddenly snapped for no apparent reason and began killing as many people as possible. Most often, this impression doesn't coincide with reality. Usually, within several days of a mass killing event, the details of the killer come to light. Almost always, we discover that the killer had an extensive criminal record and/or a history of mental illness or violence or all of the above. There is a significant segment of our society that would have you believe that otherwise healthy and productive citizens suddenly snap and go on killing sprees because they are infected with a killing virus by the NRA or because just the mere presence of a firearm set them off. Thankfully, a growing number of Americans are seeing through this plot to strip law-abiding Americans from their legal firearms. I did the research on this story and found out that the killer already had an extensive criminal record prior to this event. Here are a few things to consider. First, normal people just don't snap and start killing as many people as possible without a reason. Almost always, there are pre-attack indicators. Many times, they planned their attacks out well in advance and even bragged to others in person or via social networking. There is almost always advanced warning. In this case, the man snapped because a mother asked him to slow down while driving through the parking lot when her children were playing. To you and I, that seems reasonable. But to an evil person who feels no accountability or has a mental illness problem, that's reason enough for murder. Second, consider the woman defender. She drew her gun, aimed, and fired multiple times and killed the violent criminal. She stopped the deadly threat using a gun, and it's highly unlikely that she could have thwarted a high-powered rifle with her bare hands. Good people use guns to stop bad people with guns. That's a fact. And third, most on the far left, including President Biden, want to disarm American citizens regardless of their character, their motives, or their background. But here's the deal. Guns are simple tools just like hammers and saws and kitchen knives. Guns don't commit crimes, and guns don't stop crimes. All inanimate objects are at the mercy of humans with hands and hearts. A good-hearted person will use the gun to protect and defend innocent life, and a bad-hearted person will use guns to take innocent life. It's really quite simple. Guns are used over 2 million times a year to stop violent crime. If Americans are disarmed, then criminals will rejoice and rape, pillage, and plunder with wild abandon. Frontlines of Freedom salutes this protector defender from West Virginia and praises her courage and skill because she stopped the senseless and needless killing of a whole lot of people.
She sure did. Our movie of the month is Monmouth County 9/11 and its aftermath. You can go to the Frontlines of Freedom website, go to the blog and get the link. You can watch it for free and we'll review it at the end of the month. And I'd really appreciate getting your comments about it. Send them to me at denny@frontlinesoffreedom.com. Next week on Frontlines of Freedom, veteran Ross Schwamm will discuss the role of Hessians in our nation's military history. Then Army vet Shad Messner will share about the National Veterans Foundation, and we'll discuss the Battle of the Month with General Chris Petty. We'll be looking at one of our nation's battles each month with General Petty. Our book, Frontlines of Freedom, with 19 authors, has the mission of helping all patriotic Americans step up and help our nation return to our traditional values of serving, not being served, of being in shape physically, mentally, and morally, of being proud of our nation. You can purchase that book at frontlinesoffreedom.com. Please help us get this call to action book into the hands of all Americans.
Thank you, friends, for joining us for Frontlines of Freedom today and every week on this great station. Please check us out on Facebook and add your comments. And if you missed any part of this show, hey, all our shows are available on demand at frontlinesoffreedom.com. We especially thank our military listeners for serving our country with honor and dignity and for keeping us all safe. God bless you and your families as you serve.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Thank you, listeners all across America, for joining us in the foxholes on the front lines of freedom. Stand tall, be proud Americans, and join me next week for military and veteran information that you won't get anywhere else on the front lines of freedom. Dismissed.